This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Baseball is back. And so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Thursday afternoon, March 7th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. The Bears are reportedly close to unveiling their plan for a new dome stadium on the lakefront. We'll take a deep dive in our next segment. Right now, the latest reports on layoffs and jobless claims are out today. Let's break down the numbers with the help of Diane Swonk, Chief Economist, KPMG in Chicago. Diane, thank you for joining us today. The government jobs report comes out tomorrow. The ADP report suggesting hiring ticked up a little bit in the month of February. But, there's still a lot to howl about, as it were, when it comes to layoffs, which are ticking up and actually are reaching numbers we have not seen in 15 years.
We are seeing an increase in layoffs. The question is whether or not we can continue to absorb those increases in layoffs. And so far, so good. That's been the good part of the numbers, is that we have seen an ability to really absorb a lot of the layoffs that we're seeing announced out there. It's important to remember that back in the 1990s boom, we saw a surge in layoffs and we were able to absorb them. The question is this economy, as it quote unquote normalizes, it's kind of not, there's nothing normal about it. Is it going to be more like the 1990s or more akin to what we saw pre-pandemic, which was the 2010s, which really were a very subdued growth kind of period? I think one of the most important issues to be watching, this is International Women's Month, and it certainly is important to look at the care economy. And what we're seeing is the child care crisis is having an impact on the ability of women and how many hours they can work. They're actually working an hour less than men were in today versus 2019, and that's mostly because of voluntary part-time employment, which includes having to stay home due to childcare problems.
Yeah, you bring up a very important point, and this is something any family with kids encounters, and you don't really think about it until you're there, and that is, who takes care of the kids? Does someone stay home? Do you pay for someone to take care of the kids? Does it make economic sense to pay someone? And what happens if you can't find someone to take care of your kids? That is a real major issue that a lot of people face, and that was an acute problem as we came out of the depths of the pandemic, and as you're telling us, it's still there.
It is, and it's affecting the labor market. In fact, we see almost 325,000 fewer women in the ages of 55 to 64 participating in the labor force today. And that's important because they're particularly sandwiched between caring for grandchildren and elderly parents, and they're at the epicenter of the care crisis within families. It's not just women, of course. There are men who are caring for children and their elderly parents more as well, but we are in a care crisis in the United States, and that's where employment gains have been the strongest, as well as in healthcare and social services.
84,638 planned cuts in the month of February per Challenger Gray and Christmas. That's the highest number since February of 2009, which was really the bottom of the financial crisis. But back then, that was 186,000 layoffs. So, yeah, it's a high number, but in perspective, it's still half of what we were dealing with 15 years ago.
And it also is, churn is something that happens in a healthy economy. People forget that those numbers were going to record highs in the 1990s as well. And so as long as we can continue to absorb them, that's the good news. If we can't continue to absorb them, that's something we have to worry about more. And that's where sort of the tightrope the Federal Reserve is walking right now.
Diane Swonk, Chief Economist, KPMG in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, the latest on the sports stadium drama in and around Chicago.
This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Public amenities and public subsidies are reported to be part of the latest proposal for a downtown Bears stadium. Let's get the latest from Justin Lawrence, reporter, Crane Chicago Business. Justin, thank you for joining us today. And we're starting to get some of the details about a new Bears stadium that would be located just south of where Soldier Field is right now. And what are some of the highlights?
Yeah, so we're starting to get this in drips. Or, you know, they haven't released a full plan yet. I think that might come sometime soon. But, you know, they will sell this as part of a larger project to kind of reconfigure that museum campus. You know, obviously that's where the Soldier Field exists now, and the Field Museum, Adler Planetarium. And that's always been, you know, a desire of the city to make that site a little more accessible to the rest of the city. The city's grid, and especially for concerts and big games at Soldier Field, it can be a real hassle for people to get to. So the Bears, you know, they would like to build a new dome stadium on the lakefront there. They have not said exactly how much private financing will be involved in this, but speaking to people, you know, I spoke to State Rep Cam Buckner. He said he believes the NFL would be willing to put up a $400 million loan. This is not unusual. The size of that might be a little unusual, but the NFL does have a loan program that they make to teams building or renovating new stadium or renovating their stadiums. And then the Bears would have to match that to make the loan possible. So that's, you know, that's $800 million there, and kind of pushing up to $1 billion if they have other kind of private financing involved. But that doesn't mean that the public won't be asked to subsidize a portion of this. You know, I spoke to a stadium expert, Mark Gannis, who says the NFL's latest stadium, it's the Allegiant Stadium out in Las Vegas, which just hosted the Super Bowl, that if that was built in Chicago, you know, it'd cost roughly $2.5, $3 billion, he said. It's a hard to see it being built for less than that. So, you know, that's a big gap between what the Bears might be able to put themselves and the total cost of the stadium.
And the Bears and the White Sox are both going to the state of Illinois with hat in hand, asking to possibly tap the hotel room tax that is used by the Illinois Sports Facilities Authority to build both facilities. And in both cases, it seems like the state subsidy won't come close to fulfilling the final cost of the project. So how far along are we in the process of trying to make the math work, and can it work at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think because all of this is kind of coming hot and heavy right now, especially over the last month, it may feel like it's further along than it is. But, you know, the baseball analogy, we're in the first, maybe we're in the second inning now, right? But the White Sox and the Bears, you know, the state leaders, they want to see actual financial plans, not top line numbers. What are your assumptions behind the revenue estimates that you think the hotel tax can continue to generate, right? They expect some growth in that year over year, but are your assumptions of how high that's going to grow yearly really, really based in reality? And then, you know, this is complicated by, right, the state Senate President Don Harmon told the teams to work together and come to us with one ask. I don't think that means exactly like we are asking for X billion dollars together to be split between us, but something more along the lines of like, here's what we think it would take for both of us to build our stadiums and the kind of financial structure and tax needed to do so. And so the teams are working together, kind of mixed signals on what that working together exactly means right now. But, you know, they're in that process, and the state leaders are trying to find out more details as well.
Justin Lawrence, reporter, Crane Chicago Business, thank you for joining us this afternoon with the very latest on the effort to build a new Bears stadium.
It's 60 minutes of financial planning. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Parent company Dine Brands Global is considering a combination of IHOP and Applebee's restaurants. Let's discuss the prospects for success with R.J. Hodevy, head of analytical research at the Los Altos, California-based foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI. RJ, thank you for joining us today. And what makes sense about this combination of the International House of Pancakes and Applebee's? Why could potentially IHAP work?
I like that. Well, on the surface, the reason why they're doing this is to get more usage out of a restaurant location throughout the day. On one hand, you can serve breakfast with IHOP customers in the morning. You can extend that through the afternoon and you eventually transition into more Applebee's fare. So the real use behind this is, or the real motivation behind this is really getting maximum utilization out of their restaurant locations. This is something we've seen across the quick service restaurant space, a lot of co-branded locations through many, many different concepts, out there as well. So it's something we've seen there, but less so in the casual dining and sit-down dining sector.
Yeah, this is not entirely a surprise. I mean, the Yum brands, you see lots of combo KFC, Taco Bell locations, and the combined Dunkin' Donuts, Baskin-Robbins locations. So as you point out, this is not necessarily new, but how is this going to change restaurant utilization? I mean, you can use it all day, but what will this combined entity look like, and what are some of the ways that it can use this combo to save money?
Well, that's the thing. That's the question, is how, if it can be successful in saving money. The idea that if you have one store and you can get more people in throughout the day, you can expense or leverage your expenses better there. You can spread it out through the rest of the day. You can have the same wait staff and do things like that. The challenge with this, though, is the complexity. You know, the fact that you're adding effectively two restaurants in one, that can be very complex, and it may end up diminishing the customer experience. So that's one thing. The other thing is just that it is potentially wait staff, trying to get them on board with two different sets of menus. That can be a challenge as well. So there's a lot of things I think that DineEquity is going to have to figure out. Dine Brands is going to have to figure out here. They do have some co-branded locations in their national markets, and we do see sometimes in situations like that where similar co-branded locations, but less so in the U.S. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, and if it's successful, I would imagine some other brands would be willing to look at this.
If you have some success with this concept overseas, I mean, there's one that's in Mexico, for example, among other international locations. Does the international market and the American market, does it line up? Can you learn some lessons from the overseas experience before introducing it in America?
You can get some takeaways from it, but at the end of the day, too, they are different markets and different consumer behavior, different taste preferences, different dining expectations. And so I think it's something where you can, glean some learnings just in terms of operations and how to run a business, but you also have to be mindful of factors that are different in each market. And I think that's going to be the challenge here. What we've seen is that some breakfast sit-down locations, like a First Watch, have done very well by really focusing in on the experience of that breakfast. And so if you try to put both of them together, both a breakfast and a dinner experience in the same restaurant, it may not translate over as well. So it'll be interesting to see how they manage those expectations with customers. I think that's going to be the interesting one. They work in international markets because there just are fewer of those locations, and it's a good way to build out two brands at once. But it'll be interesting to see how that translates over to the U.S. market.
RJ Hottovy, Placer AI, thank you for joining us today.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
This is Chicago's news, traffic, and weather station, News Radio 105.9. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Seesawing temperatures are contributing to a proliferation of potholes. President Biden will make his case for a second term when he addresses the country tonight in his State of the Union speech. It's Technology Thursday. We'll consider the impact of artificial intelligence as we move through the campaign and toward Election Day. The TSA is trying out a new security screening system for airports. markets. Business, the markets are higher. The Dow is up 171 points. The NASDAQ is up 243. The S&P 500 is up 51. We have 49 degrees right now under partly sunny skies, going up to 52 inland. It's 12:31. Topping our news at the half hour, President Biden delivers his third State of the Union address tonight. CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Nancy Cordes says there will be running commentary as he speaks.
With the president's speech set to soak up attention, his GOP opponent, Donald Trump, is promising to do a live play-by-play of the State of the Union address. Trump also announced that he's willing to debate Biden anytime, anywhere, after refusing to debate his primary opponents.
We'll have live coverage of the president's address and the Republican response starting at 8 o'clock tonight right here on WBBM. The Chicago Department of Transportation says it's making significant progress in maintaining streets by repairing a huge number of potholes. This is Acting CDOT Commissioner Tom Carney.
We ask the public to help us help you. Please use the 311 system to help identify street and alley pothole locations that need attention from our crews.
He says workers have filled more than 140,000 potholes across the city so far this year. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are in positive territory. Once again, let's see what's boosting stocks with Shah Galani, Chief Investment Strategist with ManWordPress.com in Miami. Shah, thank you for joining us today. And it appears that markets are getting to boost once again from good inflation news, not only in America, but across the world.
It's not only that, Rob. I think congressional testimony by Fed Chairman Jerome Powell yesterday and today is likely to warm the hearts of investors that there will be at some point cuts coming. And I think markets are optimistic that it will probably be the second half of the year. I don't think that the expectations are for the five or six cuts that they had back in December, looking for maybe two, three. And I think the markets think that's plenty right now. As long as inflation is the right trend, it's a time to buy stocks as high as they are, as lofty as they seem. Valuations are really not out of whack with what's the potential for earnings to catch up.
It seems like some of the hotter than expected inflation reports earlier in the month dangled the possibility of maybe no interest rate cuts this year. So as you point out, investors like the lack of a surprise in the congressional testimony, and they also like the fact that he said, yes, the interest rate cuts are still on the table for 24.
Well, they're still on the table, but I think he also had to do what he had to do credibility-wise and put out there if things change, if inflation was to rear its head again, then without saying it, he implied that a hike would certainly be on the table if things reverse. But nobody sees that happening right now, barring some exogenous shock that sends oil, WTI through the roof, you know, up to $110. That would change the landscape as far as the inflation outlook, but that doesn't seem likely right now. So investors are very happy with what they see. The AI narrative is moving stocks, and it's all good so far. It's green on the other side, and the sun is shining down on the market.
We're talking today's market activity with Shah Galani, Chief Investment Strategist with ManWordPress.com in Miami. Let's talk about productivity and AI, because it seems that one of the big inflation fighters over the past year, above and beyond interest rate hikes, is the fact that the American worker is more productive. You're getting more output per worker than you did before. And on top of that, there's just the potential of AI delivering productivity gains in the future. So at what point do you, when you're making that bet, do you think it's the right one?
Well, I think it's already the right one. I think investors see that it's the right one. Productivity is going to have a downside for workers. I think it's going to see some increased unemployment. But as far as companies go, top line, bottom line, revenues and earnings and profitability are going to be helped by the fact that they're going to be able to cut employment. And they're not going to miss a beat because AI will pick up the slack and probably be more productive and certainly have less cost in terms of overhead as far as benefits, as far as health care, all the other costs associated with employees. That alone is what investors are looking at, not even going into what AI will actually do. Going down that path, investors are, I don't think they've ever been more enthusiastic about what that can do for bottom line earnings for companies across the spectrum.
Is there a ticking clock problem for Jay Powell? I mean, obviously, if you're the chair of the Federal Reserve, you want to say you're apolitical, but at the same time, it's impossible to be apolitical when you're in Washington. And is he concerned, or would he be concerned about cutting rates later in the year, just because that's when the presidential election is hot and heavy and you don't want to be accused of doing something to help the guy in the White House right now?
That's an absolutely perfect question to ask. I wish I had the answer. Yes, they're supposed to be apolitical. Are they? Ultimately, no. The party in power generally has sway over the Federal Reserve to whatever degree investors believe. I think it's probably a lot more than they think. We know that this the particular board, the board as it is right now on the Federal Reserve, and especially the Open Market Committee, predominantly favor the Democrat Party. And I think it wouldn't surprise me to see a cut in the summer or before the election. I think that would spur the market even higher. And that's another reason I'm optimistic to think that the markets, though they appear to be lofty, can go higher.
Shah Gilani, Chief Investment Strategist with ManWordPress.com in Miami. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Technology Thursday, AI companies are concerned about the misuse of their platforms for partisan political purposes.
Money talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday. There are rules involving the use of artificial intelligence to create misleading images in election content, but that doesn't mean they're being followed. We're joined by Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for the news site Axios.com, based in San Francisco. Ina, thank you for joining us today. And are tech companies and the government, are they bracing for 2024 and the potential for AI images to create mischief and doubt in the voting process?
I think bracing is a really good word. My worry is that they're not doing enough to prevent it, but they definitely are bracing for it in terms of the potential for generative AI to create all sorts of havoc, whether it's incorrect information about voting by accident, whether it's deliberate disinformation by candidates, whether it's outside influence from foreign countries, or just supporters becoming too enthusiastic and creating images that don't really exist of their candidate, as we saw with these deepfakes created that make it look like Trump was with a bunch of black supporters who, in fact, were pure AI fictitions.
Yes, and they all had multiple arms and 14 fingers, and there were all sorts of signs that the AI did not get the image exactly right. And I'll give you an example. I'm sure you've seen it as well online, but it's this picture of the 80s man in the restaurant that's been going around. It's a guy with like a long flowing locks of 80s hair, big bushy mustache. He's wearing a torn jeans vest, and he's sitting at what looks like an 80s McDonald's with an ashtray right there. And everyone thought that was a real picture until you looked in the background and you realized that McDonald's was misspelled and that the arches were incorrect. But people believed it, and people thought it was real, and they were making jokes about it. And at the end of the day, AI misinformation, is that our problem, or is that a tech problem? Is it our fault for believing it and wanting to believe it instead of just looking a second time?
It's both. I think right now there are these telltale clues that you mentioned, particularly text. I'm looking at one right now of the Trump with the black voters, and it actually looks quite realistic, except for the text on one woman's shirt and one guy's hat aren't actually legible. I think the idea that humans and individuals are responsible, though, ultimately is both true and insufficient. So I think it will be the case that it will be important for us to all step up our media literacy, and that's one of the most valuable tools we have against misinformation. But I think it's also true that the creators of these powerful tools need to do everything they can to label AI-generated images, to ensure their technology isn't being misused. I'm not convinced at all that we won't have a big problem, not just in the U.S. election, which obviously we're most focused on, but more than 1 billion people around the world are going to the polls this year. And as as hard as the problem is in the U.S., I think tech companies are going to have an even harder time in foreign languages where they don't have a lot of expertise. But obviously, we're most focused on the U.S. election.
We're talking AI images and election threats with Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios in San Francisco. Who is the larger threat when it comes to misinformation and phony or doctored or out of context images online? Is it a foreign government? Is it Russia? Is it China? Is it Iran? Or is it just somebody in the United States who likes the attention?
Those are all real threats. I'd probably, if I had to point to one, I would say Russia, only because we know that they've been doing this now for 8 years. It's an area of focus, and now they have these more powerful tools that require even less skills. So I would be shocked if they weren't trying to figure out how to use it. And the images are one thing, but I also think text, just sowing discord through just false stuff. And then the thing I always find important to point out in these discussions is there's actually a second threat, which is the existence of misinformation. The existence of AI fakes also is going to allow candidates, and I would certainly expect this from the former president, to claim that real stuff is fake. He's been claiming fake news since before there was AI, and I think anything he doesn't like, he's just going to say is fake news and point to AI. So that's also a risk worth keeping in mind.
So keep your head on a swivel in 2024. Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios in San Francisco, thank you for joining us today. Join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, airport security could be heading to the next level.
The only program dedicated to currency events. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The Transportation Security Administration testing a self-service screening system at Reed International Airport in Las Vegas. Welcome in Joe Brancatelli, editor and publisher of JoeSentMe.com in New York. Joe, thank you for joining us today. And this self-service system, assuming it passes the test in Las Vegas, does this mean that the TSA can just open more security lines and eliminate that choke point at the airport?
Yes, theoretically, Rob, but it could take years for this thing to get through. The TSA has tested a lot of things over the years that never came to fruition. So don't expect to go to O'Hare or Midway in the next couple of months and see a self-service option. That's not likely.
How does this work in Las Vegas? I understand this is for the TSA pre-check people only, and that is the people who paid a fee to undergo the background check and do all of that so they can go not have to participate in the full security procedure when they get to the airport.
Correct. Well, once you've lost all your money in Las Vegas, you don't have a wallet anyway, so that's one less thing to go through.
It's true.
But with PreCheck, which basically gives you a lot of rights, you can leave your coat on, you don't have to take off your shoes, you basically put your bags on the counter as you would normally do, and a machine goes through them as it would normally do. The key change is you walk into the screening area where they screen your body by yourself, and you arrange your body in a way that the machine tells you to. It has a visual display of what might not be in the right place. And that's where I actually see the pain point, because that's a very difficult and precise procedure. And then you'd be clearing. So you'd never see an agent, just like now, you probably pump your own gas. Or before I got on the phone, I literally read my own electric meter. Ostensibly, self-service can work, but there's a lot of bugs to work out, a lot of issues yet to still look at. So it could take a long while before we see it.
And even the technological component, assuming you can perfect that or get it to a level where in which it can be scaled up and be used at airports across the country, then you talk about the potential legal issues if the self-service machine pings you for something that you don't have.
Well, yeah, but we have the same legal issues now when the machines might ping you. I've gotten my zippers pinged, you know, or you forgot you left a dime in your pocket and it found the dime. So there's always an issue, potential issue. This is just technologically tricky. It probably could be overcome, but this is not something I'm betting on in the next couple of years, Rob, although I do think it could reduce waiting time in the long run, because like any other business, the TSA is having trouble finding human beings to do things. So the more self-service options they can employ, the better chance you have of getting people what the TSA charmingly calls throughput through security and through your plane.
Joe Brancatelli, editor and publisher, joesentme.com in New York. Thank you for joining us today.